print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 9th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: some of the biggest Obamacare companies are seeking hefty premium increases for 2027, often for the second year in a row. Global oil prices surged 5.2% in their steepest one-day jump since May, after Trump said the truce with Iran was over. The Dow and S&P 500 fell 1.1% and 0.3% respectively, while the NASDAQ rose 0.2%. Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' space company, is working on a $10 billion funding round that would value the company at $130 billion, a person familiar with the matter said. A Trump family crypto venture that channeled more than $500 million to the family is in talks to sell its core business to chain block tech company Perpetuals.com. Burger King restaurant operator Minor Food is planning an IPO that could become Singapore's largest food and beverage listing in years, according to people familiar with the matter. Air Canada ventured outside the company and country for its new CEO. China's auto sales remained weak in June, with retail sales of passenger cars slumping 20.2% in the first half. Apple plans to spend more than $30 billion with Broadcom in the next 5 years as it ramps its investment in U.S.-made chips. China said it has found security backdoor vulnerabilities in Anthropic's popular Claude code. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Trump said he believed his ceasefire deal with Iran was over shortly before the U.S. launched more strikes on the country as retaliation for attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz. The president said he supported Ukraine's strikes deep inside Russia, calling it an escalation that could help end the long war. Democratic nominee Graham Platner said he would halt his campaign for Senate in Maine after he was publicly accused of sexual assault. He continued to deny wrongdoing. A federal judge ordered Trump to pay the $5 million in damages to writer E. Jean Carroll after the Supreme Court declined to hear his appeal of the defamation and sexual abuse verdict. An Idaho mother who said her twin toddlers died after getting routine vaccinations has been indicted on charges of murder, accusing of suffocating them. A former Wisconsin judge was spared prison after being convicted of obstructing federal agents seeking to arrest an immigrant. just under half of Americans say capitalism is working very well or even somewhat well, down from 60% who said so about a decade ago, according to a new Wall Street Journal NORC survey. The Trump administration is pressuring Cuba's government by zeroing in on one of its few remaining sources of hard currency, the doctors and nurses it deploys abroad. The picture on today's front page takes place in a city dwelling where three young men dressed in red jumpsuits, carrying backpacks, and wearing what appears to be a metal helmet, are bending over investigating the contents of a plastic bag. And that caption reads, "Ukrainian medical workers inspect the body of a person who was killed by a Russian missile strike in the city of Kharkiv." The article, "Trump in Shift, Backs Ukraine Striking Targets Deep in Russia. President Says He Will Consider Letting Kyiv Manufacture Patriot Missile Interceptors," by Robbie Gramer, Anastasia Malenko, and Brian Schwartz. President Trump said he supported Ukraine striking targets deep inside Russian territory, calling it an escalation that could help end the war. The comments mark his strongest praise yet of Ukraine's military strategy and deal a significant blow to Russia's efforts to keep Trump on its side in talks to end the war. In a marked contrast to past meetings between the two leaders, Trump opened his session with President Volodymyr Zelensky on Wednesday by offering warm words and fresh promises of military cooperation with Ukraine, providing a major boon for Kyiv and its supporters in Europe. Trump praised Ukraine's bravery, signaled he would consider granting Kyiv a license to produce U.S. Patriot missile interceptors, and said he would consider traveling to Kyiv at the right time in peace talks. Ukraine has run critically low on Patriot missiles, which have been used to intercept Russian ballistic missiles. The shortage left its capital and other cities exposed during deadly large-scale Russian attacks this summer. The path from licensing rights to standing up production lines for Patriot interceptors could take years, and Trump didn't offer more specifics on the plan. It's an escalation, but it's also an escalation that could help lead to an end, Trump said, of backing Ukrainian strikes deep inside Russian territory. He spoke during a session with the Ukrainian president at the NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey, on Wednesday. Other articles from the front page follow. President declares an end to ceasefire with Iran. Tensions with NATO allies about the Iran war were on full display. U.S. launches fresh strikes after Trump's threats in latest sign of talks unraveling, by Rami Grammer, Brian Schwartz, and Lara Segelman. Ankara, Turkey. President Trump said he believed his ceasefire deal with Iran was over shortly before the U.S. late Wednesday launched more strikes on the country, extending a skirmish that began with Iranian attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz and snarled efforts to reopen the strategic waterway. U.S. Central Command said the Wednesday strikes on Iranian targets were designed to further degrade their ability to threaten freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz. Explosions were reported in Bandar Abbas and Sirik, the same sites the U.S. hit in Tuesday night's round of attacks, according to Iranian media. The attacks were broader in scope than Tuesday's, hitting many of the same targets, as well as missile and drone storage areas around the Persian Gulf, a senior U.S. official said. The U.S. also struck bridges that it said were being used by Iran's military to transport missiles, drones, parts, and other material, the official said. On social media, Trump called the strikes retribution for Iranian attacks on commercial ships near the strait this week. Airbags worn above faulty inflators marked as made by Chinese company, by Ryan Felton. A. Wee Sok King lost control of his Chevy Malibu in torrential rain late one night in October 2023, spun sideways across two lanes of a Texas road, and was struck by a pickup truck. When his airbag deployed, it tore apart his jaw. I couldn't breathe. I felt like something was stuck in my throat, Kang recalled in an interview. He lost half of his lower jaw, most of his lower teeth, and some upper teeth. Over the next month, he underwent three surgeries, including for an infection and facial reconstruction. The airbag, it turned out, had been purchased on eBay and installed by the Texas dealership that sold him the used car. When he crashed, it sent metal shards flying into King's face. King survived, which made him luckier than others. The aftermarket airbag in his Malibu contained a dangerous component tied to at least 10 fatalities in the U.S. since 2023, according to a later report by federal safety officials and a government email reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Three others have been severely injured, including a driver as recently as June in Louisville, Kentucky. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is racing to stop more drivers from being killed or injured by airbag parts, it says, appeared to originate from the Chinese manufacturer called Jilin Province, Detianu Safety Technology, also known as DTN Airbag. Plattner halts Maine Senate campaign, by Tarini Party. Democratic nominee Graham Plattner said he would abandon his campaign for the Senate in Maine, ending a run for the office that had drawn broad grassroots support, but was plagued by a growing series of controversies. Plattner's decision came just days after he was publicly accused by a former romantic partner of sexual assault, which he denied. The move allows the state Democratic Party to find a replacement on the November ballot to face incumbent GOP Senator Susan Collins in what Democrats consider a must-win seat in their fight to take back the chamber. Plattner announced his exit in a video Wednesday night, in which he blamed the media and political establishment for acting as judge, jury, and executioner, and continued to deny wrongdoing. In the 11-minute video, Plattner said he was targeted by Democratic forces that oppose his brand of populist politics and were desperate to get him out of the race. The sexual assault accusations prompted top Senate lawmakers, and close allies to rescind their endorsements, cutting off funding, and call for him to drop out by Monday, the deadline set by state law. Blattner said he would file paperwork to officially withdraw from the race. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Obama insurers seek hefty rate rises. Facing sharply higher insurance bills, millions of policyholders are dropping ACA plans, leaving a smaller group of enrollees who are generally less healthy and costlier to cover, by Anna Wild Matthews. Rates for many Affordable Care Act plans rose by double digits this year. Insurers want to do the same next year. Some of the biggest Obamacare companies are seeking hefty premium increases for 2027, often for the second year in a row. In Washington state, Centene is asking for a 28% increase after boosting rates by 35% in 2026. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Illinois wants 15% on top of a 28% increase this year. It is a stunning jump when you add both years together, said Cynthia Cox, Senior Vice President at KFF, a health research nonprofit. At the request of the Wall Street Journal, KFF analyzed the rate request for the largest ACA plans by enrollment in 15 states where insurers' 2027 filings have already become public, as well as the District of Columbia. Surging ACA premiums are likely to become a focus in the midterm elections, with Democrats expected to emphasize health care affordability. ACA insurers said they are dealing with the same factors that pushed premiums up in 2026. Health care spending, including on pharmaceuticals and hospitals, is still rising rapidly. Already, the number of Obamacare policy holders fell to 19.2 million as of February, from 22.1 million a year earlier. Actuaries said more people are likely to leave later this year and next. Costco cashier feels like $1 million, by Sarah Nassauer, Tucson, Arizona. Costco cashier Tony Bazaar unloaded his lunch in the break room, clocked in, and headed for the checkout, just as he has for much of the past four decades. That day, like most days, the 60-year-old Bazaar was assigned to the self-checkout area, a cluster of six registers. At 9:02 a.m., the first shoppers were ready to ring themselves up. "Right here, ma'am," Bazaar said, gesturing for a customer in line to move to an open register. "How you doing today, sir? Find everything all right?" he said to another as he circled the registers with a scanning gun. Long-tenured workers like Bazaar are Costco's secret weapon. They are reliable and experienced, able to speed shoppers through a checkout line and serve as mentors to newer workers, passing down the company's unique culture, Costco executive said. Bazaar's pay and benefits reflect his value to the company. He earns $32.90 an hour, and the holdings in his 401k have boosted his retirement savings to more than $1 million, he said. His Costco-sponsored healthcare has a regular visit copay of $15, a specialty visit copay of $25, below the national average. In 2009, Bizarre Family bought a three-bedroom, two-bath house with a pool, and they have traveled to Europe twice over the past decade. As a younger person, I didn't think me and my family would reach where we sit now, he said. I could retire, but what would I do? Costco has been good to me. Rhode Island is at war over a wall. Fix for sinking hole at golf course stokes old debate. By Owen Tucker Smith. Paddling up Narragansett Bay, a kayaker spotted a strange new development between the Quineset Country Club and the sea, a heaping pile of rocks. Then all hell broke loose. First came the phone calls. The kayaker alerted activists who informed the state, which dispatched a team of investigators to inspect the stone structure. The wall, 2 football fields long and 20 feet tall, stood between the 14th hole of the club's golf course and the water. State officials, convinced it had been built illegally, issued fines and demanded its destruction. In Rhode Island, rising sea levels, erosion, and a centuries-long debate over shoreline access have made coastal development a lightning rod. Yet no issue has animated locals quite like the Quineset seawall, which has spawned tense hearings, lawsuits, countersuits, investigations, and a boycott. It looks like it was dropped onto the site from Mars, said Topper Hamblett, executive director of Save the Bay, an advocacy group. The family business that runs the club insists the wall was necessary to prevent the 14th hole from slipping into the sea. Erosion has eaten away at the course for years, Jan Companies says, thrusting its future into uncertainty. Lawyers for the club argue that the 526-yard par 5 is its signature hole, the hardest and most aesthetically pleasing on the course. Their defense rests partly on the threat of a doomed spiral. Without the hole, the club couldn't host professional tournaments. Without tournaments, the property value would sink along with the dirt and turf. So an array of contractors built the wall out of stone and cobble in the dead of winter without a permit. And nobody's been able to stop talking about it since. The company calls the wall built in 2023 a last resort. State regulators went back and forth with the company for years. Multiple parties concluded the wall was illegal, and yet it never came down. In May, 999 days after officials first inspected the wall, the Attorney General filed suit. Leaving the front page, China says it finds Claude Code flaws. By Raphael Wang. Singapore. China said Wednesday that it has found security backdoor vulnerabilities in Anthropic's popular Claude Code, stepping up tensions in the race with the U.S. for artificial intelligence supremacy. Several versions of the American coding tool, released between April and June, can send sensitive information, such as user location and identity, to remote servers without the user's consent due to a built-in monitoring mechanism. China's National Vulnerability Database, a government-run cybersecurity platform said in a statement. The agency warned such a mechanism could pose a serious threat. It advised users to uninstall the software or update to its latest version. Last week, Chinese tech giant Alibaba told employees that it would ban their use of Claude code at work from this Friday. Anthropic didn't respond to a request for comment on China's Wednesday statement. The U.S. company has previously said that Chinese companies such as Alibaba aren't eligible to access Claude. In response to the allegations on Reddit, an Anthropic employee said on X that the code was part of an experiment the American startup started in March. The experiment was meant to prevent account abuse from unauthorized resellers and protect against distillation, the employee said. Ex-judge won't go to prison in ICE case by Mariah Timms, Milwaukee. A former Wisconsin state judge was spared prison on Wednesday after being convicted of obstructing federal agents seeking to arrest an immigrant who appeared in her courtroom. Hannah Dugan, then a judge on the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, was arrested and charged in April 2025 by federal authorities who said she directed a man to leave her courtroom via a back hallway when she knew immigration officers were in the courthouse. Dugan, 67, was suspended from the bench following her arrest and later resigned. In December, a Milwaukee federal judge found Dugan guilty of obstructing law enforcement, but acquitted her on a charge of concealing a man wanted by immigration authorities. The arrest came as the Trump administration was ramping up deportations of people in the country illegally. During a sentencing hearing in federal court Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Lynn Edelman fined Dugan $5,000 and declined to sentence her to prison or probation. U.S. targets Cuba Lifeline, its army of overseas doctors, by Vera Bergen-Gruen and Ryan Dubay. A Trump administration's pressure campaign against Cuba's communist government is zeroing in on the island's most valuable export and one of its few remaining sources of hard currency, the doctors and nurses it deploys abroad. The U.S. has blocked fuel shipments, imposed sanctions on, and indicted its top officials, and curbed money Cubans abroad send to relatives. Now the effort to throttle Cuba's decades-old medical missions, through which Havana gets payments to export doctors and nurses to more than 50 countries, threatens billions of dollars in revenue for a country in economic freefall. Trump administration officials have pressed nations that employ Cuban medical workers to end or scale back their contracts, threatening visa restrictions and other penalties for foreign officials who don't comply. A State Department spokesman said the U.S. is sharing information about what it calls the program exploitative practices and urging governments that use Cuban doctors to hire and pay them directly instead of through Havana. During a swing through the Caribbean in March, Secretary of State Marco Rubio lobbied political leaders to stop paying Cuba for doctors, saying its government was carrying out a forced labor scheme disguised as humanitarian aid. The regime does not pay these doctors, takes away their passports, and basically it is in many ways forced labor, he said. Cuba says it has sent medical workers abroad since 1963. Havana realized that its missionaries for the Cuban Revolution were a financial lifeline, raking in about $8 billion a year at their peak just more than a decade ago, said Ricardo Torres, a Cuban economist at American University. In 2024, the past year for which official data is available, the missions generate about $5.3 billion, or half of total Cuban exports, he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Trump tells the truth about Iran. The age of innocence ushered in by J.D. Vance lasted 3 weeks. My whole life, all I do is deals, President Trump said Wednesday. But Iran's regime is from a different school, he had to admit. They're liars, they're cheats, they're sick people. Mr. Trump cited the tens of thousands of Iranians slaughtered by the regime in January and explained how its word has proved worthless. I don't want to deal with them anymore, he said. The president is so mercurial that it's impossible to know if he's serious that the ceasefire is over, as he said. He could declare it back on tomorrow. But he's right that Iran's regime has been wasting his time. It's the best in the world at that. 20 days into the Memorandum of Understanding 60-day negotiating period, nuclear talks have hardly begun. Instead, the regime has worked to conquer the Strait of Hormuz while exporting billions of dollars worth of oil. New satellite imagery suggests Iran is continuing construction at its underground Pyxxaxe mountain site, a violation of its commitment in the MOU to maintain the current status quo of its nuclear program. That is why the upfront U.S. concession on oil sanctions was a mistake, without requiring the revenue to be held in escrow. Mr. Trump revoked the oil sales license on Tuesday after Iran struck 3 commercial tankers in the strait with missiles and drones. In June, Mr. Trump called Iran's new leaders very rational people who were nice to deal with. Vice President J.D. Vance, the lead U.S. negotiator, insisted that even the thugs atop the Revolutionary Guard Corps want to turn over a new leaf with the U.S. This age of innocence lasted all of 3 weeks. Perhaps Mr. Vance will tell us why he believed that and whether he still does. Asked on Wednesday, what changed his view of Iran's leaders? Mr. Trump answered, I got to know them. The question is what the president will do with that knowledge. He said talks could continue, but added, I'm not sure I want to make a deal. Let's just finish the job. That won't get done with on-again, off-again talks and tit-for-tat bombing. Any U.S. action risks escalation, so it had better be with a strategic purpose. The MOU bought both sides breathing room, but the true options for Mr. Trump haven't changed. He can surrender the strait or reopen it by force. He can reimpose and enforce maximum pressure sanctions and the blockade on Iranian ports. He can target Iran's oil infrastructure or enriched uranium stockpile. The U.S. seems to be escorting some tankers through the strait, and Central Command's Admiral Brad Cooper has a plan to do more to reopen Hormuz. This would involve going on offense to clear the threats near the strait, not merely swatting drones and missiles. If Mr. Trump shows that Iran can't stop the flow of energy, while the U.S. can blockade Iran anytime, that's victory and leverage. If he can remove Iran's nuclear material and destroy the Pyxxaks mountain site, that's victory too. In both cases, the goal is to free the U.S. and the region from dependence on the cooperation of Iran's regime. We've played that game before, and maybe Mr. Trump is tired of it. Better to reopen the strait or destroy the nuclear program ourselves and let Iran's regime struggle under pressure while it's at its weakest. From the opinion pages, socialists spell trouble for Democrats. They can win in deep blue districts, but they'll weigh down the party elsewhere. By Carl Rove. America is politically polarized and narrowly divided. In the last presidential election, Donald Trump received 49.8% of the aggregate popular vote, while Kamala Harris got 48.3%. By that measure, it was the fourth closest White House contest since 1888. Now consider three New York congressional districts and two Colorado ones, where self-described socialists won primaries last month, some of them with formal endorsements from the Democratic Socialist of America, DSA. Four of these districts split very differently from the nation as a whole in 2024. In New York's 7th, 10th, and 13th districts, and Colorado's 1st district, Mr. Trump received 19.3%, 14.1%, 11.1%, and 22% respectively. Ms. Harris's victory margin in the district ranged from 56 to 77 points. These are indigo districts where Republicans have no chance. If Democrats win back the House in November, it won't be because of these rock-solid districts. It'll be because Democrats flip Republican seats in districts where Mr. Trump either prevailed or came close. The DSA candidates in these deep blue districts will create problems for all Democrats before and after November. Before the election, they will help Republicans paint the Democratic Party as radical. One of them, Daria Liza Avila Chevalier in New York's 13th District, posted on X that this country is a effing disgrace. She later bragged, "I forgot to get napkins, so I just wiped my hand on the American flag behind me." The City University of New York doctoral candidate and Columbia graduate said, "All cops are bastards." She's also called for no more police at all, ever, and the abolition of prisons and immigration enforcement. Republicans will make her the face of the Democratic Party. Ms. Chevalier and her comrades will create additional problems for their party if Democrats win the House. They're dismissive of party leadership and certain to press their extreme views aggressively. This will further unsettle not only traditional Democrats, but also swing voters who already rate the Democratic Party less favorably than they do Mr. Trump. The greatest peril from the Democratic Party's DSA wing will be in districts that more closely mirror the narrowly divided nature of American politics. That's what makes Colorado's 8th district interesting. Mr. Trump won it by 2 points in 2024, 50% to Ms. Harris's 48%. It runs from Denver's northeast suburbs in Adams County up Interstate 25 and U.S. Highway 85 to Greenlee in Weld County. It spans suburbs, farm and ranch country, and one of America's largest gas fields. The district is represented by Republican Gabe Evans, who served a dozen years in the Army and National Guard as a Black Hawk helicopter pilot. He was deployed to the Middle East and did search and rescue work and fighting in Colorado. He was then a police officer in a Denver suburb for a decade before serving in the Colorado House. He was elected to Congress in 2024, flipping the district from the Democrats. He serves on the Homeland Security and the Energy and Commerce Committees and is a member of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. His opponent is State Representative Manny Rutinel. He has a master's from Johns Hopkins and a law degree from Yale. Like Ms. Chevalier, he holds very left-wing views. At Yale, he called animal agriculture a horrific, exploitative industry. He testified before a Connecticut legislative committee that the globe must shift away from animal production. Now he said he's no longer a vegan and eats beef. That Weld County is home to half of Colorado's cattle might have something to do with his change of diet. In a Working Families Party interview last year, Mr. Rutinel endorsed universal single-payer health care, canceling student debt, shifting money away from the military, policing, and prisons to fund critical social services, and banning hydrofracking. After beating a moderate Democrat in the primary, he's moving to abandon some left-wing positions. He already says he now favors an all-of-the-above energy strategy. He has also buried postings he made in 2013 and 2014. Only headlines remain on the internet. Among them are, "What Would Jesus Do?", "Socialism?", and "Why a More Socialistic Society is Superior." Socialists running in deep blue districts can keep saying outrageous things and win. But it's places like Colorado's 8th District, pitting the former Army helicopter pilot against the leftist Yale law graduate, that will decide which party runs the House. Game on. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Mandani emulates Elon Musk. New York's Commission on Government Efficiency, or COGE, is a promising and surprising effort. By Kate Farmer. Sauron Mandani may loathe billionaires, but he is taking inspiration from the world's only trillionaire. In May, New York's mayor launched the Commission on Government Efficiency, or COGE, obviously patterned after Elon Musk's Doge. Apart from Mr. Musk's department's focus on tech, Doge and COGE are remarkably alike. In its founding executive order from President Trump, Doge committed to modernizing federal technology and software to maximize governmental efficiency and productivity. In its first press release, COGE, spelled C-O-G-E, commits to removing outdated bureaucratic barriers that slow infrastructure projects, modernizing government to improve efficiency and saving. Even more striking is that Messrs. Trump and Mandani agree on a good idea. COGE's deregulation and government efficiency agenda is promising. If it stays true to that mission, COGE could make New York a healthier climate for business and reduce government bloat and spending. COGE's 16-member governing commission is mostly diverse, and not only in the DEI sense. 2. Mark V. Shaw and Annie Oliveira are alumni of Mike Bloomberg's administration. Catherine Wild is a board member at the Center Right Manhattan Institute and former CEO of the Partnership for New York City, a business advocacy group. COGE is holding public hearings across the city's 5 boroughs, 7 so far, with 3 more set for this summer, where experts and members of the public can testify on changes they want made to the city charter. Many New York business owners and developers attended the first hearing on capital project delivery and permitting on June 9th. Based on the hearings, COGE would propose amendments to appeal on the ballot in November. One proposal before COGE from the nonprofit Abundance New York is to consolidate the messy bureaucratic process behind building permits. Developers often must seek approvals, permits, and inspections from a dozen or more city agencies, such as the Departments of Buildings, Environmental Protection, and City Planning. The proposal would designate the Buildings Department as the single authority overseeing requirements for all other involved agencies, so developers aren't subject to repetitive paperwork and delays. Another proposal from a Bronx hearing would expand the fiscal impact statements that accompany proposed legislation at the City Council. The statements cover a bill's cost to the city budget for 2 fiscal years. The proposal would require an additional small business impact statement. Other proposals include procurement reform, which would pay city contractors more quickly, and removing the revocable consent requirement for outdoor seating, which can trigger 6 months or more of multi-layer review just for a restaurant to put tables and chairs outside. But COGE will confront a truth uncomfortable to Mr. Mandani. When you shrink government bloat, you inevitably shrink the government workforce. He needs the extra cash to fund his big-ticket campaign promises like free public buses and childcare. But will his union base understand? Some of his code commissioners may not. The group is dominated by pro-union advocates. When DOGE began work in Washington, it sparked panic inside the Beltway. The code crew probably won't have a similar effect. But the real question is how CODES will reach its spending reduction and government efficiency goals without big cuts. Mr. Mandani and big labor appear to have a cozy relationship, but it's beginning to fray as bodega owners criticize his government-run grocery stores and stream fitters unions condemn socialism. Coge's tightening of New York City's belt could instill similar discontent. As much as Mr. Mandani needs the extra cash and efficiency, time will tell if he has the political will to see it through. The Infettata at MIT by Barton Swaim. Few committees have ever produced anything worth reading. Exceptions include the King James Bible and the Declaration of Independence, but not the various reports issued by elite universities on campus-based anti-Semitism after October 7, 2023. Harvard's report usefully collects reams of data, but gums up its findings with bogus claims of Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian bias. Columbia's report refers to anti-Semitic activities only in general terms, boasts at length of the corrective actions, and generally avoids acknowledging the depth of the university's failure. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, meanwhile, issued no report at all. Its president, Sally Kornbluth, managed to keep her job after failing to give a clear answer to the question put to her by Representative Elise Stefanik of whether calling for the genocide of Jews violates MIT's code of conduct. Just as well, Yossi Sheffi, a professor of engineering, has produced his own report, Unsafe at MIT, which he self-published Tuesday. Mr. Sheffi, born in Israel in 1948, has taught at MIT for 48 years and has no plans to retire. The book's early chapters remind us of a fact noted often in these pages, but easily forgotten, namely that the anti-Israel campus protest didn't arise in response to the war in Gaza, but to Hamas terrorists murdering, maiming, raping, and abducting thousands of Israeli civilians on October 7th. The agitators didn't demand a return to Israel's borders in 1967 or a two-state solution, but the Jewish state's eradication. Mr. Sheffi has interviewed scores of Jewish and Israeli students and recorded their heartbreak. Overnight, many of their peers, professors, and advisors turned into adversaries. Ms. Kornbluth, in a statement published October 10, 2023, said that, in my opinion, such a deliberate attack on civilians can never be justified, and lamented the conflict that will also gravely harm or kill many Palestinians in Gaza, this long before Israeli forces entered Gaza. Many students and postdocs lost friends and illusions that week, Mr. Sheffi writes. The infinite corridor, the school's main passageway, now sprouted rows of folding tables draped in Palestinian flags. Chalked slogans appeared on walkways and walls. Kafifas became the accessory of choice across classrooms. Laptop covers were suddenly plastered with red, green, and black stickers, often in the shape of Israel, and bulletin boards bristled with libelous denunciations of the Zionist state. The book lives up to its title. Mr. Selfie relates stories of students blocked from campus thoroughfares, targeted by name as Zionist in online forums, taunted outside their locked office buildings, and screamed at by outside agitators, all in flagrant violation of school policy and, in many cases, of federal law. Meanwhile, the administration caved in to the demands of protesters, punished few, if any, for flouting campus rules, and pretended not to know the meaning of Intifada and red handprints, the latter an allusion to a Palestinian proudly brandishing his bloody hands after the lynching of two Israeli reservists in 2000. If any other minority had been treated as Jews and Israelis were on America's finest campuses 2 years ago, we would have seen National Guardsmen patrolling their leafy quads. Asked for comment on the book, an MIT spokesman sent a statement pointing out that high percentages of the school's Jews now say they're happy and feel safe at the Institute. But the statement acknowledges failure, however obliquely. MIT leaders look back at the time the book describes and recognize the anguish and struggle members of our community experienced. The Institute has made great strides since then and remains committed to this important work. Mr. Sheffy's account reminds us of the campus protest's most dispiriting irony: the inverse relationship between the idiocy of student protesters and the prestige of their institutions. They had no interest in learning. Again and again in Mr. Sheffy's narrative, Jewish and Israeli students, many of them politically liberal, recalled their mistake in assuming they could reason with their Kafifa sporting peers in trying to speak to them. Mr. Sheffy's book describes a great American institution avidly betraying its principles. Those aghast at the Trump administration's rough treatment of MIT and other elite institutions would profit by lowering that mental placard and pondering the severity of the betrayal. You've been listening to a reading of features and articles from the July 9th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day or evening, and enjoy the weekend.